Welcome to the Hunt Backcountry Podcast. This is episode 64. In the previous few episodes, we've asked for your feedback on what you want to see in 2017, whether that be a certain topic or a guest or just a question that you want answered. And just want to give a shout out to Adam Hartwell. He was one of the many listeners that sent in his feedback. And as we told you guys, we would be selecting someone to receive some Exo Mountain Gear swag for submitting those ideas. So Adam, thank you so much. Please contact us with your shipping information and we will get some Exo Mountain Gear swag sent your way. All right, in this episode, episode 64, it is just Steve and myself again, and we are answering more of your questions. So this is kind of a continuation of the Beginner Basics questions series. Hopefully you guys enjoyed the first episode. This is the second Q&A specific episode, and we dive into some great topics. Also, just want to give you a heads up about the next episode, kind of in this Beginner's Basic series, but it's not a Q&A, at least not your questions and our answers. This is going to be an episode with you, essentially, with an everyday listener, someone who contacted us, who kind of told us his story and said that he would love to see some more interviews or content from everyday guys. And I basically said, hey, it's your idea. You have a great story. Let's get you on the show. So this next episode is going to be really cool as we talk to somebody who went on their first Western hunt last year. It was an elk hunt. They did find success, were able to kill a bull, but it wasn't all smooth sailing. They learned some lessons along the way, learned a ton about the process, everything from what information was valuable before the hunt to things they learned during the hunt, and then how they are preparing now after the hunt, what they learned, what they did right, what they did wrong. It's going to be a great episode. So come back for episode 65. But let's go ahead and dive into this one, episode 64. As always, guys, we would love to hear your feedback. You can email us to podcast@exomountgear.com, or please, if you're enjoying the show, consider leaving us a review on iTunes. And here we go, episode 64, your questions, our answers. All right, Steve, welcome to the show. How you doing, man?
Oh, I'm doing really well, man. It's just another January day here and just dreaming heavily of hitting the backcountry or getting out and bear hunting or something. It's I got the winter itch going on for sure.
Yeah, I had a four-day weekend with work and it was so excited to get out, and it iced and rained the entire time, so I was stuck inside doing honeydews and remodeling my daughter's room and playing with tools instead of outside playing in the outdoors. So hopefully next weekend.
Yeah.
So you're just back from ATA. Yeah. Kind of a different experience from ATA. You didn't get to shoot a bunch of bows because your shoulder's still bugging you, things like that. But anything else that stands out, anything cool or noteworthy, any trends? Like, I know last year, I guess I should say this is the first year I haven't been to ATA in 5 years or so, but last year, like, a big trend is when it seemed like every company and their brother was coming out with a proprietary camo pattern. You know, that's been going on for a few years, but last year it was just like everybody. Did you notice any other sort of like just trends in the industry, new products, like overall things like that, or kind of more of just tweaks to existing things?
Yeah, I would say it's more tweaks towards existing things. We talked about this briefly last year too. Unfortunately, all these big kind of buying groups are coming in and buying up all these little companies, and it's just kind of, it's unfortunate to see, because I think innovation kind of slows down. These big corporations come in and buy up a company, and they're just focusing on, you know, maximizing sales and profits and not so much on product development. But that said, there's still a lot of great companies out there, you know, pushing forward and doing things. I did see I don't know how new this company is, but Gearhead Archery. It's like the first bow I've seen in a long time that's like truly like outside the box thinking. It's really cool. It was like just two flat sheets that are kind of have a waffle type pattern to them. And they're just basically bolted together, and it's like a shoot-through riser, and then the limbs are attached up at the top, and there's a split-limb deal with cams, and
really?
It was a really cool, you just kind of saw that, and it's like, So it feels like the first time in a decade I saw a bow and go like, man, that could be, you know, that could be the future. That could be something new and different, you know. So that was cool. And then, yeah, go ahead.
No, like, were they touting any specific improvements or advantages to their design that you noticed?
You know, it's going to be extremely rigid. They had a really cool, there's basically a plate right above the grip, kind of the shelf that formed the shelf. And through that shelf, you could bolt the grip on in different positions. And it had two bolts that went down to the grip, so you could move the grip left and right and forward and back 1 inch. So you could essentially kind of play with the draw length and kind of where the bow sits as far as hand placement and torque, which was really cool. Yeah. And then they had a carbon version that was just insanely light. I think it was low 3 pounds-ish. So it was just something different and cool.
Yeah.
Definitely the trend in patterns, companies coming out with their own thing. I mean, it just makes sense. You know, if I was frankly Realtree or Mossy Oak, I'd be, you know, freaking out at the moment, because I don't think currently there's a Western company or a clothing company producing Western clothing that's doing a Realtree pattern or a Mossy Oak pattern.
Yeah, I can't.
I'm not aware of anybody. Yeah.
Right.
And if you're Sitka or First Light or whoever, you know, it's a brand identity. You see a certain camouflage pattern, and if it's Fusion, you know that's First Light. You know, if it was in Max One, that could be clothing you bought at Walmart or something. So it just makes sense. And frankly, I think these companies are kind of driving innovation. You know, Fusion's a fantastic pattern. I think it does a great job breaking up stuff. Sitka just came out with their new Subalpine, which is a really good looking pattern. You know, I think they do a better job than the old stuff of breaking up your outline and making you harder to see by elk and deer.
Yeah.
Other than that, yeah, you know, the cool thing about ATA show, it's a pretty small show. And so Tyler Okamura, who works part-time for us at EXO putting the packs together, he came with us. You know, it's his first time, and we were talking about it today just briefly of you get there and you realize how small the industry is, especially kind of among the Western group of guys. You know, it's not like there's thousands and thousands of guys out there. Really, everybody kind of knows everybody. For the most part, guys are really cool. So it's kind of fun to go back and visit and hang out with guys.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Cool. Well, let's get into kind of a part two of this series. Hopefully you guys have caught part one in the previous episode, but just answering a bunch of listener questions that we were backlogged on, and really some of the questions that are, you know, more basic, more towards beginners, which, you know, we're all about helping everybody. So just want to tackle these things. You know, speaking of the proprietary camo, we have had numerous questions about camouflage. Does it matter? How important is it? You guys even asking specifically about why are all these companies making their own patterns, which you hinted at. You know, as you said, it's brand identity, but I mean, too, from a business standpoint, it makes a ton of sense, because every time these companies were printing something in Realtree or what have you, they're paying licensing. Yep. And so that whole model's changing, and not only are they free to innovate, and like you said, what First Light has done with Fusion and their new pattern Cypher, you know, it's not just them coming up with branding. There's more to it than that. In fact, we have an episode, last year, some point, with Joseph Skinner, if you guys want to go back and listen to that, who is really studies in depth camouflage, and he's actually the guy who was commissioned essentially by First Light to make their pattern. So, you know, there's more to it than that, but that's certainly a brand. But just to get back to the basic premise, does it matter? How much does it matter? What are your thoughts there, Steve?
You know, camouflage is a tool that you can use to kill an animal. It is by no means the best tool that you have, you know, in your toolbox. That's between your ears. To me, it's kind of on the bottom of, you know, if I had to list 10 things that were, you know, essential to killing an animal, it's probably going to be number 10 on that list. It can definitely help you get away with things at certain times, but it's by no means necessary. You know, just, you can always do the old reference of guys used to kill a lot of animals in blue jeans and a red flannel shirt. You know, I've been in wearing completely solid colors and had elk at 10 yards away from me, just looking right at me and right through me. I think if they can't wind you and they really can't, they don't, you know, they don't see you move, you're going to get away with a lot. But I think where camouflage can help is if you do move and maybe they catch movement and then they start staring your direction, you know, then they can kind of, you know, they'll stare at you and then maybe assume you're nothing if the camouflage is a good pattern and it's breaking up your outline. So yeah, I guess that's my stance on it. It's something nice to have, just like selecting a, you know, the right broadhead or the right bullet, but by no means is it absolutely necessary.
Yeah. Or do you find it to be more important, at least for the hunting that you've done on like muleys versus elk, for example, when you're in more of a stalking situation than maybe hunting the timber and then a calling situation for elk?
No, I wouldn't say so. You know, a mule deer and elk, they're both going to have, you know, really good vision. Mule deer, I feel like you can't get away with anything. If they don't care what pattern you're wearing, if you're within 50 yards and they catch you move, you're SOL. And elk, you seem to get away with more, you know, typically you're going to be more cover, more timber and, you know, stuff behind you and brush and stuff like that. So, yeah, I don't know if it one matters more than the other.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I've certainly had, you know, I waffle on the question, because I've had so many experiences so like, no, it doesn't matter at all. I mean, I've had animals close and I was wearing, you know, solids or some form of, and then there's been times where, you know, I've known that it's made a big difference in having animals really close and literally, you know, having them look through me. And even after, like you said, a brief bit of movement, they're still just confused, and not sure what they saw or what they're seeing. So yeah, it's like, it's, I think it depends on the situation. As you said, it could be helpful. It's certainly not, you know, up there in terms of what's really most important. And, you know, it's definitely not important as, your hunting approach and your skills and your smarts and
yeah,
you know, all the basics for sure. So,
yeah, I think as you're, a good way to put it would be if I had to have the decision between wearing like nicer, more technical clothing that was solid or wearing cotton camouflage that I bought at Walmart, it'd be no question I'd wear the solid stuff, because that the clothing itself, you know, is going to perform better and allow you to stay out there longer and probably give you more of an advantage.
Yeah, that's a good point. All right, so all that said, it's clearly not the most important, but, you know, gun to your head, you have to choose some camo. What are you reaching for?
You know, we've worn ASAP for a long time. It's a phenomenal pattern at breaking up your outline. And then we switched to Fusion a couple years ago, and frankly, I wear brown pants and then a Fusion like top. And I've had good luck with that. I've had plenty of animals. Like I said, you never know if it's the pattern or it's just the surroundings and the environment. And I've had animals close by and not been busted. So yeah, Fusion. And then I think we're going to play around with the new Cypher pattern this year as far as it's designed a little bit more for the Western hunter, kind of dry climates.
Yeah, cool. All right, so there's so many, you know, I guess camo could be one of them, but there's so many different options in terms of gear, what's important, what, you know, someone should be spending money on, all these gadgets and gizmos and things that are marketed. Guys get overwhelmed, and this guy's asking, what's really important? What's the one piece of kit that you would always pay full price for? I mean, we talk and have mentioned, I think even on the previous episode about, you know, don't get stuck. You don't have to buy a hunting this or hunting that. You can buy stuff used. You can buy good gear that's not hunting specific but works well. But when it comes down to it, what's the one important thing that you are always going to spend money on and pay for quality?
Yeah, I think we mentioned this on maybe it's the last podcast that hasn't aired yet that we recorded. But the top of the list are boots and packs. If your feet are killing you and covered with blisters, I don't care how tough you are, that's going to be a miserable experience and you're probably going to want to hike out of there. So making sure you got good footwear, along with that is good socks, you know, just a good merino wool sock, take care of your feet. And then frankly, you know, you don't have to have a good pack if you're just hunting from the truck or the four wheeler and going a mile or two. You could have just a cheap little day pack and probably a pack frame back at the rig that if you killed something, you could go in and out with. But if you are truly backpacking, backcountry hunting, you know, getting 3, 4, 5 miles away from a road, a good pack is essential. It's just going to make something that could be miserable, you know, rather just quite comfortable. It's a big deal as far as, you know, getting that meat out of there. And frankly, you know, you got 30, 40 pounds on your back all day long. Just being comfortable makes a huge difference. From there, it's clothing. You know, stay away from cotton. I really just wear, for the most part, merino wool on all my base layers. And then, you know, good technical synthetic outerwear as far as jackets and stuff like that goes.
Yeah, for sure.
Stuff you can get away with, you know, a lot of it comes down to, you know, there's really good gear. It's just not, that can be cheap. It's just not going to be light. So that depends on you. You know, if you want to get into a tent for cheap, that's heavier. It's the quality is probably going to be there. It's just going to be heavier. Same with like a sleeping bag, you know, you can get a synthetic bag that's going to be heavier and bulkier as far as if you got a 15 degree synthetic or a 15 degree down bag, you know, that synthetic could be $200 and that down could be a $400 or $500 bag. Performance wise, sleeping, you're not going to really notice a difference, but you will notice a difference in your pack on the space and weight. Sleeping pads, kind of the same deal. Stove, you know, I started off with like a Brunton Raptor stove quite a while ago and it worked just fine. A Jetboil is a heck of a lot nicer, but you could probably pick up one of those Raptor stoves for $20. So
yeah.
There's definitely a lot of areas you could skimp on.
Yeah, for sure. All right. So, you know, you mentioned the pack and maybe it's not important if you're hunting from the truck, but we have had multiple questions from guys who are new to Western hunting. They're struggling to find a hunting partner or someone to go with that's willing to hunt the way that they want to and get into the backcountry, things like that. And they have questions about packing out game solo. Mm-hmm. It's such a loaded question, especially for someone who's never done it. And I mean, my first bit of advice or answer is to say, don't do it. but I know that puts guys in a bind because some, you know, there's guys out there who are just, you know, they're dying to do, you know, the backcountry elk hunt or what have you, and they can't find somebody to go with. I'm not saying it's impossible, but at the same time, if you haven't done it, I don't, like, you almost can't comprehend how much work it is until you've done it, and especially being solo. What are your thoughts?
It's absolutely doable. Definitely be in shape, be smart about where you're hunting, right? Don't stop at the, or start at the top of a ridge and drop 4,000 feet down in the bottom and kill an elk down there. You know, I would pick a place where you could hit a trailhead that works up a canyon. So anything you kill is going to be a downhill route out of there. You know, it's my elk this year. It wasn't super far from the road, but, or from the trail, but, you know, it was doable. Killed it at night. And, you know, quartering an elk by yourself is kind of tough. And then kind of handling those quarters and getting them up into a tree and letting them cool down isn't easy either. But from there, just take your time. I would never, don't overload yourself. If I'm by myself, I'm going to do more lighter trips. Just, you know, the probability of getting injured when you got 140 pounds on your back jumps up pretty high. Trekking poles, definitely, highly, highly suggest, even if you're not going to pack them when you're hunting, have them in the truck so that you can, you know, they can help you packing out. They just make you so much more stable, help take the weight off your knees, you know, when you're going down steep hills. So I would highly recommend a trekking pole. Other than that, yeah, it's just going to be more work, but it can be done for sure. You know, and especially deer, you know, most guys, if they have a fairly light camp, can pack out a deer in one trip. You know, again, you're going to be 120, 130 pounds on that load, but it's definitely feasible.
Yeah. Would you, in a situation where you're solo and packing out an elk, are you doing any sort of like shuttle strategy in terms of meat and doing sort of like a frog hop approach? Or are you taking a load all the way out to the truck, coming all the way back? How do you break that up? Or I guess it might depend on, you know, the terrain and how much ground you have to cover.
Yeah, totally. terrain and how much ground. I've killed a couple of elk in the past where they were down in a hole, and so you had to like a 1,000-foot climb to get up out of there, and then once you hit the ridge, it was kind of down and out like 3-4 miles. I got all the meat to the top of that ridge because in theory you're going to be, you know, you have the most energy and have the freshest legs at the beginning of that. So I got all the elk meat to the top of the ridge, hung it up, and then from there I shuttled, made trips back out to the truck. So that was a good strategy for doing that. But you know, again, if it wasn't, it was just kind of a short up and then down out to the truck. I think it's just a judgment call.
Yeah. And what are your thoughts on, and again, I guess I'm trying to cater this to guys who are new to it and maybe haven't done it, but what are your thoughts on killing an elk in the evening and it's a decently cool evening? Should they wait and get some rest overnight if they can get that elk hanging and cooling? Should they try and get to work right away, pack through the night? Is it, you know, completely up to the individual? Any pros and cons that jump out at you in those situations?
I would never waste a trip, number one. So definitely, my elk this year is exactly what I did. I killed them right at dark. Took the hour or so it took to get them all quartered up, got all the quarters and, you know, neck meat, back straps, everything off in bags, hanging. And then that first night I took out both front shoulders, went back, went to camp. You know, it was freaking cold, 30 degrees. So that's not an issue. But that, even if it was, you know, 40 degrees or 50 degrees at night, I don't think there's any reason to pack through the night. Unless you're, you know, even hanging in a tree, you'd probably be just fine. If you were in really bare, dense country, that might be a consideration. But it's, you know, as long as you get the quarters away from the gut pile, you know, that's definitely, I pack the quarters probably 7,500 yards away from the gut pile so that, you know, if a bear's going to come in, he's going to go to that gut pile and not to your nice clean quarters hanging in the tree. So, so I just got a quartered, hung, did the two fronts, and then came back the next day and two more trips packed out the rest.
Yeah, cool. So this is a question that we've gotten a few times, and it might be a short answer, but ideas and input on trail cameras. What features do you need? What do you don't? Where's the best place to set them up? What time of year? How often should you check them, etc.?
I rarely use trail cameras.
That's why I thought it might be a short answer.
the last one I did was on my mountain goat back in 2014. I put one up in a saddle just to kind of see what was crossing through that. It's a real high rocky saddle with the trail going through it. And crazy enough, I got elk on the camera, which blew my mind. But I rarely use them. And in some states, I know, I think Montana, it's illegal to even use them. So they're definitely a good asset. I think, you know, for us, we don't have a lot of value. It's not that there's a lot of value, but if, like, for mule deer, if I was going to go scout somewhere, I mean, everything's a, you know, a day trip hiking in and scouting and coming back out. If I was to leave a camera there and then end up finding a buck some other place, it'd be a whole trip I'd have to make to get back into that country. Mm-hmm. So it's a little different than walking out, you know, in the whitetail woods behind your house and set one up. You know, it's be a lot more effort to get back and get one out. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you think of elk and gosh, I mean, you might be checking them. You might be having good activity, summer range, but you have to think about when you're going to have the opportunity to hunt those elk. Are they going to be doing the same thing? Are they going to be in the same area, even remotely using the same patterns? I mean, there's all kinds of factors that go into it.
Yeah.
You know, and plus it's just, you know, there's, I think the thing that gets me, especially with, you know, like Western hunting and covering these big areas is, you know, and I experienced this back in the Midwest too, just cause you catch an animal on the trail camera and maybe even, have a buck or bull somewhat consistent, it doesn't mean they're going to be there. And just as importantly, if you're not catching something on your trail camera, that doesn't mean that something's not there. You know, it's just not crossing right in the short little range that it takes to trigger your camera. Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's kind of a blessing and a curse. And I've seen it bite guys where it's like, you know, they invest so much time into a spot or into a specific animal because they have good trail camera photos. And they've also given up on spots because they don't have good trail camera photos. And as it turns out, you know, it ends up being a productive spot. So, yeah, I mean, they're certainly fun, I think, for sure. It's always exciting to see what you can get. But I don't know. I can't put too much weight into what they do or don't pick up for me in the years that I've played with them.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, they can be a great tool and asset, but also could possibly hinder you.
Yeah. So this is a question that we've addressed a bit, and is probably a bit personal preference in how we do things, and is something that as a beginner I can totally understand where you're coming from. But a guy's asking about what spares to carry in their pack, such as clothes, socks, underwear, etc. So what spare clothing items to have? And then do you wash and wear a set of base layers? Meaning, do you have like a set you're hunting in and a set you wash and then swap the next day, etc.? So I know that's nothing that you nor I do, but I guess go into A, why you don't, and then kind of B, why you don't have to at all. It doesn't really matter.
As you're saying that, it reminded me of that podcast we did with Andrew Skirka, and he said the first time people pack too much because they pack their fears. Mm-hmm. And frankly, there's just no replacement for getting out there and doing it and learning from, not your mistakes, but just learning what you need and don't need. Highly, highly suggest having an organized gear list. And, I did this early on, and it really will help you whittle down your list. Is just at the end of a hunt, get home, unpack your pack, and just put a check mark next to either the things you used or the things you didn't use, and just kind of do that after three or four trips, and you're going to see a pattern of like, I used to pack extra underwear, never freaking used them. I used to pack rain gear, very rarely ever used that. You just start to whittle stuff down. What we've talked about in the past too is I always have spares at the truck. And so worst case scenario, I don't pack an extra release. Worst case scenario, I lose, half a day if I go super light pack to haul my butt out of there and get a release and come back in. It's never, ever happened to me. I've never had to go a trip out to the truck once in, the last decade of hunting. So it's, to me, it's not worth, some guys, it's absolutely worth packing the extra 5 ounces of release weighs. For me, it's not. So I think that just kind of comes down to your preferences, but at least monitor it and figure out what you're using and what you're not, and then just stop packing the stuff that you're not using. And like we said, it's not like, if you're in Alaska, dropped off in the middle of nowhere, that's a whole different situation. But most of us here in the lower 48, you're hard pressed to get, 10 miles deep is extremely far for without, you're not at 10 miles, you're probably closer to a different road or trail system than what you started on. And, most of the country we do, we're between 3 and 6 miles. And frankly, past that, killing something, that becomes quite a chore. Going back to solo, packing an elk, solo, I would say 4 miles would be about the max you'd want to handle, because that's going to take better part of 2 days to get that out of there. I think you just have spares in the truck. It's what I do. And if the weather turns bad or you lose something or something breaks, you've got that option to go back out and get it. And your hunt's not over. You're not having to drive, the 3, 4, or 20 hours back home.
Yeah. So lots of good questions, and some of this stems back to a series that we've done on the podcast with, kind of some of your DIY bow stuff. But, guys asking about the ins and outs of learning to maintain, repair, and tune their bow. What would you say are some good resources for guys to get started, Steve? I know part of it's just trial and error and get out there and play and to some extent, don't be afraid to change things, right? You certainly can get in trouble, but, tinkering's not a bad thing. But any resources that stand out, what helped you learn you know, how to play with a bow?
Archerytalk.com. That's an internet forum. I'm sure most people are aware of it. That's one of the major reasons on how I got started. Was I was kind of sick of the local pro shop, or not sick of it, but you know, they're running a business there and they kind of got to get you shuffled in and out. And I knew, you know, the things could be done better with more detail. And so I just kind of started the process myself. And Archer Talk is a great resource. There's a lot of, you know, guys who are keyboard pros, and it's going to be kind of tough to whittle past some information that maybe isn't true. You know, another great option, just a really good mentor. Hopefully somebody at your local bow shop or somebody you know that's a good resource to always ping with questions. That's a good avenue to take for sure. And I know there's some good tuning like DVDs out there. None of them come to mind, but I know they exist, where some people have put some videos together really covering, you know, how to work with your bow and put it in a press and do the cam timing and set everything up. So it's definitely, you know, you just kind of got to jump into it like everything else. It's not easy, but if you put some time and research into it, you'll be able to figure it out.
One thing I would say as well is, you know, if you're truly new to archery, you know, truly new to understanding your bow and what you can do with it, make sure that the information that you're seeking out is relevant to your system. And that comes in more specifically with tuning, but you know, if you get to the point where you're tinkering with anything in terms of the cam, for example, make sure that you're not reading some post on Archery Talk about a guy, you know, talking about, you know, a prime cam system and how to set that up, and you're shooting a Hoyt, or you're on a solo cam and they're talking about a hybrid cam, you know, things like that. And that's obviously very basic, but for you guys who haven't, you know, dove into that deep and have maybe no idea what I even just said, just make sure that you are, you know, finding information that's relevant to your bow. And I would echo that Archery Talk is a great resource for that, no matter what kind of bow that you shoot. You know, along those lines, in terms of, you know, not necessarily just tuning, but things like tying your peep in, changing your peep, your D-loop, setting up a rest, whether that's a fall away or what have you, man, center shot, just understanding arrow spine, paper tuning, all of those things. I mean, they certainly take time to understand, but in my opinion, if you are going to be a bow hunter, you need to understand all of those things. And that's, you know, no fault to you if you don't yet, but I'm just saying, like, work towards that, because it's going to help you. It's going to save you so much time, trouble, and money if you're more independent in terms of doing those things.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
What are some, not just resources, but what are some of the tools, like, physically that you find super valuable, Steve, in terms of working on your bows?
So yeah, as far as tools go, there's not a whole lot that you need, really. I mean, a good Allen wrench and a bow press, and that pretty much is going to have you covered. You know, you can go, I'm trying to think of stuff I've got, arrow, saw, man, as far as leveling goes, I just have a 3-foot carpenter's level that I use. You know, most guys are going to have that in their, you know, tool bench out in the garage. Gosh, there's not a whole lot. Yeah, a lighter for tying your D-loop and tying in your peep, melting the strands. That's kind of it. I'm sure there's a few things I feel like I'm missing, but a press is a tough one, because it, you know, there's some cheap ones out there, but they are cheap. I honestly don't even know a good recommendation on a press at the moment. I know there's a company called Easy Press that makes some really nice ones, but I think you're looking at, you know, $400 or $500.
They're Last Chance Archery. They have the Easy Press, and yeah, their basic press is going to be about that. I think about $400, and unfortunately, like, it's, I think, one of the cheapest legit real quality presses. Beyond that, you're getting into more of a, you know, a cable type press, an emergency bow press, a field press. But yeah, in terms of something worthwhile to install and actually work on bows, that's kind of the cheapest price point, I think.
What's the Oh man, I'm trying to think of the really cheap cable one. I'm drawing a blank.
Yeah, I know. It's not the Apple one.
Oh.
Yeah, there's like the Boa Constrictor. That's a cable press. Yeah, there's a few out there. I think there's even guys, speaking of Archery Talk, I think there's even guys on Archery Talk making them now.
Yeah, so the Bowmaster Bow Press.
Bowmaster, okay.
Yeah, they're $37. I just had a guy email me wanting to get into working on bows and asked if that was a press that would work. And frankly, the answer is, you know, no. Yes, technically it works, but it's such a pain in the butt to use. It's really an in-the-field emergency type situation. You know,
yeah.
You're going to Alaska and getting dropped off in the middle of nowhere, that'd be a good thing to have in your gearbox. But as far as working on a bow at home, you know, you probably want a real press. So,
yeah. And there's probably some guy like listening right now who uses that cable press and he's like, it works just great. Yeah. But I guess the difference is it's inherently a bit more dangerous, especially if you don't know what you're doing, and just the time that it takes, especially when you come to making tweaks and changes and you're like, oh, I just need to like, you know, put a half twist in here. Yeah. And you're using that cable press, like those types of tinkering, you know, like you're exponentially taking the amount of time to make minor changes, and
yeah,
in the end it just becomes a huge pain.
Yeah, if you just need to set a peep sight, that's one thing, but yeah, if you're actually tuning your bow and working with the cams, it's quite a pain in the butt.
Yeah, something that I found helpful, and part of this is obviously for tuning, but part of it was just like it helped me understand how the bow worked so much, is having a draw board. Which is essentially, for you guys who don't know, a device where you can, you know, put your bow in a stationary device and literally use some sort of crank to draw the bow. So you're not holding your bow, you're not drawing the bow yourself, but you're using a device to essentially draw the bow for you. And you can do it in a slow and controlled manner. And it really helps you see how your cams are rotating, if they're synchronized, if they need to be synchronized. It helps you set exact draw lengths, things like that. And they're pretty dang easy to build. I think I built mine for, I don't know, probably $60, something in there. And I think I actually have plans for that on my old blog, Soul Adventure. So if you guys want to go check that out, just building a bow press. Like I said, I think it's helpful for tuning. Even to this day, I use it. But it was just super helpful for me, especially as I was just learning these things of, you know, like, how does it really work? What's draw length really doing? How does draw stops affect things, whether they be cable stops or limb stops? And I think it's incredibly valuable to have, and it's something that you can, like I said, build for cheap, and something you can kind of just store away in a corner and use it when you need it. So that's super helpful.
Yeah, I definitely miss that one. It's absolutely essential if you really want to get into tuning and working on your bow is having a draw board. Mine's just a boat winch. I think I bought from Harbor Freight Tools for $20, and then you need a good scale, which, you know, there's a handful of models out there that work just fine.
Yeah. I mean, they're dirt cheap on Amazon these days.
Yeah.
What else? Oh, in terms of paper tuning, guys get sometimes complex with that and like build these elaborate stands and, you know, like, you know, spool fed paper reels and all kinds of stuff, which is heck, if you want to go for it. My go-to paper tuning setup is a really big box with a hole cut in it. And what I do is take this box and set it up on a chair or what have you to get the right height that I need, and probably put another box in it to get the height. And I literally have a, you know, probably a 4 foot tall by 2.5 foot wide box with a hole. And I just, you know, I put piece of printer paper over that hole and allows me just to shoot through the paper and not obviously the box and the cardboard, and shoot, that's my paper tuning rig. So I mean, guys, you know, some guys get all into paper tuning. I still do it occasionally, and that's kind of a whole different topic, but you know, I guess what I'm saying is, you know, all these things you see don't have to be super complicated or super expensive. You know, and if you're the guy who's overwhelmed, gosh, I certainly understand that because I was the same way, but man, just get started, and it's super helpful to learn these things. All right, well, that's all the questions we're going to hit tonight. You know, listeners, if you have anything else you want us to cover in the future, we can kind of do these random fire, you know, multiple Q&A episodes once we have questions that you guys want answered. So go ahead and just email those to podcast@exomontgear.com and we'll add them to the next show. Steve, thanks for joining us, man. Have a good night.
Yep, absolutely. We'll talk to you soon.